So this morning's sermon is one I do about once a year, and I call it the question box sermon. As I said to the kids, I collected questions over the past couple of weeks. I would like to thank Sarah Jo, because there's nothing worse than being a music director trying to figure out what the theme of the service will be when you don't know what the texts are. But I like this sermon because it gives me a sense of what you all, or some of you at least, are interested in. The questions I will be answering this morning are a bit all over the place. Justice and justice making are a common theme. A couple of questions were sort of duplicates, so you might hear something that sounds like your question, but not quite. I reworded a couple. And there were also a couple of questions that came to me that really were pastoral concerns. And if that's one of your questions, I would really invite you to give me a call and let's sit down and have a cup of coffee. So here goes. How do you see the gender spectrum and sexual orientation spectrum becoming the norm or changing? And in your dream world, what would happen? Now, each of these questions will not become a whole sermon unto itself, although I could have. So we don't introduce or describe people very often by their eye color or their hair color. For instance, I doubt most of us would say, "Did you meet the new brown eye at coffee hour yesterday? Did you see the straight hair who moved into the apartment downstairs?" We don't ask people who are expecting a baby, "Do you know if it's right-handed or left-handed?" In my dream world, we would most of the time see people as a whole person, and not defined by one characteristic. It's not that gender is unimportant, but it is one characteristic among many, and yet in our society, we really peg people's identity, their value, who they are, on what their gender is. Wouldn't it be a better world if we said to expecting parents, "How's it going? What are you excited about? What are you worried about?" Instead of saying something like, "Oh, three girls, you're going to have your hands full." Or another boy, "You must be so disappointed." We make assumptions about gender all the time. So in my dream world, the assumptions would lessen or go away, even though we still might describe people with a particular gender. The following two questions are really sort of pairs of bookends, as it were. Do people know that helping the congregation physically up to one's ability is understood as part of one's membership? Do people know that financial support up to one's ability is included in the expectation of membership? So I think the simple question to this answer is yes, I think so. I don't always know what is in everybody's mind, but when folks come to membership orientation events, they hear about what the components of membership are: signing the book, making a pledge, paying your pledge, getting involved in a regular way. I think the harder part of that question is, what is up to one's ability mean? There is a quote I see fairly often: "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about." Some folks have clear limitations on their time or abilities. They might have young children at home. They might be recuperating from surgery. They might be the primary caretaker for an older person. Some folks have things that are not so easily seen that affect how they can be involved. Maybe they have a hearing loss or limited vision or a bad back that doesn't really keep them from walking or driving, but spring cleanup day is impossible. And folks have financial obligations that we may not know anything about. I have a 35-year-old who went to graduate school, so I have some understanding of this one. For younger folks, school loans can be crushing, absolutely crushing. For older folks, medical expenses can be debilitating. I don't always know who has adult children they are still supporting, or grandkids they are helping to get through school, or parents who have extra medical bills. So I'm going to assume when somebody makes their pledge or agrees to participate that they are doing it up to their ability, even if I wish they would volunteer a little bit more. There's a difference in perspective there. This one, next one, I think might be my favorite question. What are your favorite and least favorite parts about being minister of First UU? I like it because to me it connoted a sense of curiosity about ministry and me, but also a sense of care. And it's a hard question to answer because I love this church and I love being pastor of this church. As many of you know, I've been ordained for a long time, since 1985, but this is really the first church where I've been the sole pastor. And there have been some things that I've had to learn along the way. I've supervised staff before in social work agencies, but never as the pastor of a church. So that's kind of new. I supervise Sarah, Joe, and Tina. And every year, which supervising them is the fun part, by the way, but every year at Canvas time and budget time, I feel really responsible to them. I know their salaries depend on your generosity. And in that, my least favorite time of the year being minister is the annual Canvas and budget process. I don't mind asking for money. I do it every Sunday. I call for the offering. I can talk to you about our budget. I can talk to you about our needs. I have no problem talking about money. It isn't that. It's that every year we tend to spend more than we take in, and every year I worry that this will be the year I will have to sit down with the staff and say we can't cover their hours. I take that, I hold that responsibility pretty personally. And my anxieties have not come to fruition yet, and as Jim D'Aloisio the other day so kindly pointed out, the worrying doesn't do an iota bit of good. I know that. It's just me. What is my favorite part? Also hard to answer because there are so many favorite parts. I think my favorite part really is when people ask me to visit them or meet them somewhere for a conversation. I joke that the administrative part of my job is just what I do to keep busy between visits. But it's not a joke, it's actually really true. The administrative part is important, but not nearly as important as the relationships in this congregation. And I have a job where it's okay for people to ask me questions like, well, what do you think about God? Or what is the meaning of life? And why did this horrible thing happen? Those are really good questions to ask me and ones that I like to answer. There aren't very many jobs where you get that. Kind of a follow-up from those two questions, if I could change one thing about First UU or Unitarian Universalism in general, what would it be? I've talked a little bit about this before. The thing I would like to see most is for First UU to grow, not only in the number of people in this room, but in our impact in Syracuse, in the community. We as a community have a deep call to be welcoming, especially to LGBTQ folk. We are good at being friendly and welcoming, and it really warms my heart when somebody comes into our community and says, I didn't know you were here, and man, do I need this place. It is good to be here with you folks. We are we attempt to be in a covenanted relation with one another, to speak the truth, walk in love, and remember to be kind. Three easy things that sounds like, but if you try and do all three together at the same time, it's harder. But that's one of the things that we do, or at least we aspire to, and I really like that. So I'd like to grow that impact. And I think it's really the same thing about the Unitarian Universalist Association in general. Number-wise, we are a fairly small denomination. Impact-wise, we far exceed our size. So I wonder what it would mean if we grew our size as a denomination, how much more that would grow our impact. And what would that mean for the headlines in the news? How would that change policy at a government level? Here's a question that made me laugh. What soundbite or statement would you say to our president that might matter on his views and limitations on transgender people, especially with military personnel? I laughed because I don't actually believe a soundbite will change anybody's mind. Or a quick statement. And it's not just that I And I don't hold that view just with Donald Trump. I really don't think quick sound bites change people's mind. What does change people's mind are relationships. And so what I would prefer to see is some way for our government at this time to create connections and relationships with a diverse group of people so that they understood all the people they govern in this country. So, here is a tough question for you. What do you do when you are frustrated with your beloved community for not following far enough or quickly enough down the path of racial justice and reconciliation? So first of all, because I've been working in churches since 1985, I know that churches move at the speed of church. And I know church people know that because every time I say that, church people laugh. So congregations are more of an emotional system than any other non-family group I know of. And I think that makes us an amazing, wonderful place to be and complicated. We come together out of a need for connection with ourselves, with each other, with the larger world. Each of us comes here with our own particular story and baggage, as it were, and each of us comes with our own temperament. Each of us comes with our own strengths and weaknesses. Some of us are slow processors, which doesn't mean that we aren't smart, but rather that ideas kind of have to roll around, percolate a little bit inside before they come out fully formed. And some of us are external processors. So ideas come out half-formed and then reformed and reformed, and that's how we get to the idea. It's tough when you have an internal processor and an external processor trying to make a decision together. Some of us are introverts, more comfortable kind of in one-on-one conversations or time alone, and some of us are extroverts, meaning that we draw energy from a group of people. I could spend this whole sermon time talking about how we are different from one another. And I say all of this to get to the point that church systems are complicated. It is this complication that makes us powerful. We're not a one-faceted kind of group. But it means we're all in different places on that journey, on a journey toward justice. For some of us, that journey is about racial justice and reconciliation. For others, it's about fighting for equal access for folks with different abilities. For others, it's about a fight for gender equality. For some of us, our journey is not about making public acts of justice making. For some folks, their justice making is supporting the folks who do the actions. I kind of think of it this way. Three times a year, I go into Boston to work on the MFC. I take my trip to Boston, I'm in, I'm out. I have the same packing list every time. The trips tend to blend into each other, but it's easy, I'm on my own. Every other year, I go to Boston with our coming of age group. Those are memorable trips. I can tell you which kid went to the emergency room when he cut his hand. I can tell you who likes to sing really loud in the car. I can tell you what favorite foods the kids have. We spent time building a community. But it takes forever to get 15 kids three blocks in Boston. Communities move slow. And so I try to keep that in mind when I think about what is the justice work we are doing. I try to look at the progress we are making and not simply that the parts that we're not doing. There's always an infinite amount of things that haven't gotten done, and a finite number of things that we have done. But the things we have done are more powerful. So I try and keep my eye on that prize. Next question kind of is related to this. If marching in demonstrations and calling your representatives isn't what you're comfortable with or seems ineffective, what are some things that can be done to help better times emerge? So first I would say vote. Especially vote in local elections. who's on your school board, who's your mayor, who's on your town council, that really matters in everyday life. And sometimes folks overlook the local elections, thinking the national ones are the really important ones. They're all important, but especially local elections. Think about how you spend your money. It doesn't matter how much of it you have. Everybody spends at least a little bit of money. Do you spend it at local businesses? Do you think about what might be minority-owned businesses and take your business there as a way to support them? Do you try to buy your books from an independent bookstore? Things like that. It's an amazing amount of power that we often overlook. Support local charities over national organizations. Keep your dollars in the community if you can. Volunteer at your local school. Schools have an amazing power in children's lives, and they are woefully underfunded. Get to your local school and ask them to be, if you can be a reading buddy to a kid who has the worst behavior, not the best behavior. That's the kid who needs your time. Give that kid a reason to look forward to come to school. If you can't volunteer, ask your local school if there's a classroom you can be an angel for. One of the things I used to do when I volunteered with my husband's theater, and we would bring brochures about summer camp to the schools, those clips, those heavy clips that you use for bunches of paper, I would make sure they were all clipped with bunches of those, and I would throw in extras. The secretaries at the school loved me. They just don't have enough supplies. Or maybe they just need a pizza party for the kids, but they don't want it. The teachers can't pull that out of their own pocket. Get your money out of a large bank and put it in a local credit union. Again, puts the money back in our neighborhood. Think about how you spend your time and your skills. Not everybody is an activist, and that's okay. But where is your gift, and what can you do to help make the world a little bit better? Are you a gardener? Make a really nice garden in front of your house or apartment building. The people who walk by get to see it. That adds something to the world. All right, next question. Two paired questions. I got a lot of paired questions this time. Is it difficult to balance sermons when part of the congregation has some faith-based underpinning while others may cringe to hear anything beyond humanism? Yes. This is both the challenge and the charm of preaching in a UU congregation. Sometimes I hear that I use too much God language. Sometimes I hear that I am too Christian. Sometimes I hear that I am too pagan. Sometimes I hear, well, the reality is, in this congregation, on any given Sunday, someone is going to leave feeling as if their faith tradition was not spoken to. Hopefully, I speak to or engage with people's values. And it is one of the things I try to do as I speak, even from my faith tradition, is to get down to the values at the core of the faith tradition, a value of respect. You can speak across faith lines about something like that. I will say one thing I value very much about this congregation. When I have preached a little too much on Jesus, or pulled on traditional language a little too much, what I will hear from folks is a positive critique from a place of I. You know, Jennifer, I would really appreciate it, a service that speaks to my Jewish roots. I loved the time you did the Beltane service. Could you do one again? People do not come up to me and say, if you use the God word one more time, and I know colleagues who have that person in their congregation. And so I really love and respect the way that people give me feedback here. The second part or pair of this is, how can we claim words for UU like God or worship or patriotism? It seems like the far right has stolen them, those words. And I think that is true in a lot of ways. The far right has co-opted a lot of words. And so when I say church, when I say I'm a minister of a church, people who don't know me think that I have a big church with a band and a television show. And Bill Sinkford, a former president of the UUA, has written and talked about how we need to reclaim a language of reverence. And this question speaks to that. If, because we are an eclectic group, we strike all language that might be based in some kind of spiritual value or belief, then we lose our ability to speak to a diverse group with any kind of depth. But what we need to do is give it context. I might speak about Christianity from my personal experience of it, but not demand or expect that you will believe with me, but rather that you're interested in the questions I'm asking. That's a way to do it. And I think as long as I maintain an openness to humanism, atheism, Christianity, Judaism, paganism, and on, that I can, most of the time, get that balance okay. This leads into another question. Can the positive values, love, compassion, kindness, etc., decrease negative values? Yes. Again, yes. I wouldn't be in the business I'm in if I didn't believe that. And I have seen time and time again folks grow and change and find healing and love and life in a church congregation. And when they do that, then things like hate and violence and the isms that separate us are broken down. Moving away from social justice, I don't know why somebody would ask me this question. Why do some songs stick in your head? It's an interesting question because it's not uncommon on Monday morning for me to wake up with the last hymn of Sunday playing through my head. But I'm not a musician, don't know a lot of musical theory, so I Googled this one. And it turns out that there haven't been many studies done on this, but there was one done in the UK. And the team that did this study identified three reasons why earworms occur. And it comes down to pace, the shape of the melody, and a few unique intervals that make the song stand out. So apparently, faster upbeat music tends more to stick in our heads, and unusual intervals make a song stand out a bit more. Those are the ones that become earworms. Importantly, the team also did a little bit of research about what unsticks an earworm. And I feel like if I'm going to talk about earworms, I should at least give a little bit of advice. One theory is that our head is trying to figure out how the song ends, and we've forgotten. So if you can either sing it through to the end or listen to it through the end, you complete the loop and you can move on. Another suggestion was listen to a different song. Also, this is in the UK, sing God Save the Queen. This was a wide range of questions you all gave me, and next year I may just do it live as opposed to having the questions prepared ahead of time. I don't know, but what I did like was, and why I really ended up choosing the reading that I chose from Meg Barnhouse, was there were a lot of questions that were focused on justice, on making this world a better place, on building relationship and community. And this is a congregation with a strong heart. It beats hard and long and loud, and we care for one another. And that came through in these questions for me. So it was fun writing the answers to the questions, but it was also fun discovering them. So.